Welcome back to In Flight Dublin On Air. This month we're going to be talking about our favourite book to film adaptations. So I'm going to start with Fight Club and then I'll talk about Where the Wild Things Are. And then Emer is going to take over.
And I'm going to do Clueless and 10 Things I Hate About You.
209er, you are cleared for takeoff.
Roger.
Flight 209er, clear for vector 324.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Okay, so first of all, spoiler alert. If you are the only person on the planet who hasn't seen or read Fight Club, then wow, but also stop listening now. Because this is probably going to spoil it for you.
The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club.
Fight Club. The book was published in 1996. It was written by Chuck Palahniuk, who at the time was actually struggling to get an agent. So he had written short stories. And Fight Club was originally a short story before he expanded it out into the novel. But he was really struggling to find an agent and no one really wanted to publish him. And he sort of wrote Fight Club as a joke, thinking that they didn't want to publish me before. Well, look at this. But then they did publish him. So he calls his style of writing transgressive fiction, which basically means that his characters feel confined by societal norms. They try to break free of those expectations in illicit ways. And that's a really good description of Fight Club, I think.
Yeah.
So without getting into too much detail, it's centered around an unnamed narrator who's struggling with insomnia. He meets a mysterious man called Tyler Durden, and together they establish this underground fighting club, and they both find that really therapeutic and it helps his insomnia for a little while. And apparently everyone else finds it therapeutic too, because it becomes this nationwide success. And through this, Tyler Durden recruits members to play increasingly elaborate pranks on corporations, and things start getting a little bit wild as these pranks get kind of violent. And it goes a little bit crazy from there. So even though the book got really good reviews, it had a very short shelf life. And I think it was about to fade away possibly before the film was made. So the film was released in 1999. It was directed by David Fincher. And it was not a massive box office hit, actually. It did not do all that well, which is surprising when you look at how well regarded it is now. So it only got a cult following after it was released on DVD. It was starring Edward Norton, Brad Pitt and Helena Bonham Carter. And the story doesn't deviate too much from the book until the very ending, which I'll talk about now in a sec. So the film sort of places a lot more emphasis on things that weren't really emphasized in the book. Mm-hmm. So the final explosion at the end, in the book, Tyler Durden wants to destroy a museum, whereas in the film he plans the detonation of a credit card company headquarters, and that's in order to erase credit card debt.
That'd be good.
Yeah, that'd be pretty sweet. you have this sort of conflict between the film and the book where, in the book it's this anarchical, pure destruction versus a really overt political agenda. And that's not to say that Tyler Durden isn't political in the book. He definitely is. But I feel like maybe Fincher, had to make that final act of destruction a bit more obvious
or something.
Yeah, so I think...
Yeah, because museums, I don't know if you'd get many audience members on board with the destruction of a museum.
Exactly.
Whereas credit card companies, you could definitely be get them.
Yeah, and it's less obvious, obviously political, because obviously with Tyler Durden, his whole thing was anarchy and to a degree. And in the book, it's just this senseless violence. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that doesn't translate well in Hollywood. So they just made it a little bit more pointed, which I think actually worked quite well. Mm-hmm. And then on that note, with regards to making things a bit easier to swallow for the audiences, there's also the very ending. So the narrator shoots himself in the face, and in the book he wakes up in hospital and he thinks he's in heaven, and he's greeted by these orderlies who were part of Project Mayhem, which is that underground group that were playing the pranks on the corporate America, basically. And they tell him that they are awaiting his return. So this is super dark. It's despite attempting suicide, the narrator can't actually escape Tyler. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the film, the narrator, who's unnamed in the book but named Jack in the film, reunites with the sort of semi-love interest Marla, who there's this kind of complicated relationship in both the film and the book, but they're just holding hands as these buildings are destroyed, the credit card buildings, and it's just like, it's maybe a little bit
easier to swallow.
Yeah, it's a little bit nicer, kind of like, oh yeah, he ends up happy and credit card debt is wiped out. Like, what a success.
He gets Helena Bonham Carter and get freedom.
Trust me. Everything's gonna be fine. Very strange time in my life. With your feet on the air,
it's an interesting one. It's one that, like, it stays pretty true to the book, with some obvious changes for the sake of making it a Hollywood movie, which is fair. And it's just like, it's a super dark satire either way, and it's like really self-aware in its portrayal of hypermasculinity, and it's a lot of fun to watch. So that's my thoughts on Fight Club.
I'm going to go back and read it because I knew it was a book, but I've never read it. But I have seen the film, but ages ago as well. So I think I need to just refresh on both of them.
Oh, I hope I haven't just ruined
it. No, not at all. Like, I knew the big twist.
Okay.
Which you did very well on not
avoiding.
You avoided it brilliantly.
I managed. So to pivot kind of entirely on that, I'm now going to talk about Where the Wild Things Are. So, Where the Wild Things Are is a children's book. It was published in 1963. It was written and illustrated by Maurice Sendak. There's actually only 338 words, apparently. So, for those of you who haven't read it, it's about a boy called Max who has a bit of a tantrum. He's sent to his bed with no supper, and while he's in his room, it transforms into a forest, and a sea rolls in with a boat just for him. So he takes this boat and he travels for over a year until he finds where the wild things are. So these are like these seemingly scary monsters who try to frighten him. And Max stands his ground and ends up being dubbed the King of the Wild Things. But eventually he gets lonely, and despite protestations from the wild things, he returns to his room where he finds his supper is waiting for him, still hot. So it's super short. It's mostly about the illustrations. So then when it was being turned into a film, it was quite an interesting thing to do. So that was released in 2009. Spike Jonze was the director. His first move from photography to video was mostly music videos. So he's directed some of the like proper classic music videos like Weezer's Buddy Holly, Beastie Boys' Sabotage and Daft Punk Defunk.
Wow.
Yeah, so those are like three ones that like really stick out in my head from like the 90s and stuff. And then his first feature film was Being John Malkovich, which was so much fun. And he also did Adaptation with Nicolas Cage too.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen it. It's a lot of fun. I barely remember it now, but I remember watching it at the time and being like, yes, I love this. So when I heard that he would be directing a film adaptation of Where the Wild Things Are, my interest was definitely piqued. And one of the most striking things about the book is how it manages to convey so much in so few words. So like our imagination is filling in the gaps along with Max's. So turning that into a full length feature film was obviously going to be kind of a struggle. But if you can detach the movie from the book, if you can think of them as two standalone entities rather than comparing them, so that it's something unique, I think that's how you can really appreciate the film, because it's actually really, really beautiful. I don't usually call anything with CGI beautiful because I just don't think it's that pretty. I don't think it's that pretty, but it's actually not. It's not just CGI. There's actually animatronics and people in costumes in it as well. So I think that might be why it worked out a little bit better. Interestingly enough, it was not positioned as a children's film. Something like 70% of the advertising budget was adult driven. Yeah, which is, it's such an interesting take with when you look at like the fact that it's based on a children's book and, you know, the main character is a child, but they just weren't going for that. And I think that that was really smart because the film's actually somber and quite dark, and like the monsters are genuinely quite scary.
Don't say that!
No, Carol! No, stop it!
Carol!
Stop it! What are you doing?
Carol!
What?
That was my favorite arm.
Well, I was just holding on to it. You pulled away.
What?
It's pretty stark. There's not a huge amount of time spent developing characters other than Max and the monsters. So, like, I don't think Max's family even get named in it. I think it's, like, mom and mom's boyfriend and stuff like that. other than his sister. His sister has a name. And it got mostly good reviews, which is a testament to Spike Jonze's abilities, as he was working with something so lean, and he also created something quite lean. Mm. But it was something that was like, you know, when the original material is so loved and so treasured by people, it's sort of, you know, there's like a certain kind of a protectiveness around it or something. Definitely. It can't have been easy. But it did. It got mostly good reviews, and I certainly enjoyed it.
Maurice really trusted Spike to be the one to do the book justice, and not to be afraid of the book, and not to be too reverent. And I think he and Spike, in very early discussions, really were committed to refanging the book.
So those are my two favorite adaptations.
Yeah, great choices. Okay, so I'm going to choose two very similar 90s films, both classic texts that were kind of spun into high school situations. So Clueless, which is written and directed by Amy Heckerling. She had this idea for a TV series, which was based off Jane Austen's Emma. So originally she was shopping it around as a TV series, but that was kind of running into difficulties. So then she rewrote it as a feature film, and that's the one we know and love today. So it's a loose adaptation of Emma, really, and it's kind of the beginning of these teen films which were taking a classic novel and just kind of putting it in a modern setting. I guess after that we also had like Romeo and Juliet and Get Over It. Mm-hmm. And then the next one that I'll talk about, which is 10 Things I Hate About You. But for Clueless, they were hoping for a sleeper hit, and it actually became a lot more successful than they were reckoning on. So Alicia Silverstone was the main character, and so she's Cher Horowitz, which is kind of the Emma character from the books, is kind of a bored high schooler growing up in privileged surrounds of Beverly Hills. Her mother died in a freak liposuction accident. So she lives with her grumpy father. And like in the book, which her governess has just left, it's her maid has just left. So she's left on her own to kind of take care of her father. And she kind of sees herself as a bit of a matchmaker. She sets up two of her teachers in order to boost her grades, and she thinks, oh, this works. So when a new student starts in school, Ty, she attempts to boost her popularity and find her a suitable beau. And this is sort of like in Emma, where Harriet, who comes from a lower class background, moves into the neighborhood and Emma takes her on as her project. So it's kind of like a loose adaptation. I think that's why it works so well. Heckerling hasn't gone for like a straight lifting from the book. So she's like modernized it, set in the 1990s rather than Regency era England. But the spirit of Emma's character is carried over to a new audience. So when writing the Clueless script, Heckerling thought back to Emma, which is a book she read in college, as like a perfect plot to hold the optimistic character of Cher. Because, like, despite her kind of meddling ways, you still kind of root for her as a character. Mm-hmm. So Ty, anyway, is made over in Cher's image, in a way. And Cher has instructed her to spurn the advances of the sweet stoner Travis, who is just, like, the loveliest character in the film. I think everyone kind of warms to him. Mm-hmm. And instead, she has her sights set on Snooty Elton, who she has not realised is totally in love with her. And this is kind of a real nod to the book. In the book, it's Mr. Elton as a character, and he saves a picture of Ty, which makes everyone think he might be in love with Ty. In the book, it's more that Mr. Elton has commissioned a painting of Harriet by Emma Cher. So this kind of is maybe the one part where the film takes a direct event from the book, and it maybe bends the rules a little bit because it doesn't work as well with a photo and a painting, but I think in order for the reveal to happen, something like that has to happen. So it all ends in marriage in the book, but in the film, obviously, things have to be a little bit rejigged.
Cher, get in here.
What's up, Daddy?
What the hell is that?
A dress.
Says who?
Calvin Klein.
It looks like underwear. Go upstairs and put something over it.
Yeah, I was just going to.
Hey, you. Anything happens to my daughter, I got a 45 and a shovel. I doubt anybody would miss you.
So it's, as I said, like a retelling rather than a faithful adaptation, but it's the spirit of the characters that are carried over. And the costuming, I have to mention for this as well, by Mona May is total trendsetting. Like there's like 12 different types of plaid in it, I think. Cher wears about 63 outfits. And in the beginning, there's this great scene where she's like picking her outfits off the computer. And I think that was like the height of tech back in the 90s.
Yeah, so, the automated wardrobe. I remember watching it and thinking, I want that.
So cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that has really carried through, as well as the lexicon, like as if, whatever.
Yeah.
So it was a great novel and a great book. But it also kind of heralded this teen movie being based on classic text sort of trend. So in the wake of that, you had the hype of Romeo and Juliet. And two scriptwriters, Kristen Smith and Karen McCullough, thought it would be a great way to jumpstart their own script by adapting Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew to a teen movie, just as, I guess, a way to create a ready-built structure for the plot. So that's what happened with 10 Things I Hate About You, which is based on Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. So the 20th anniversary actually happened last month, which is how it kind of re-entered my radar. But it's like another great example of a classic text that's kind of loosely adapted into a modern context. So in The Taming of the Shrew, there's two sisters, Catherine and Bianca. Catherine is the shrew in question. She's volatile and resistant to the patriarchy, essentially. And Bianca is mild-mannered, amiable, and much sought after. But their father has a rule in place that only Bianca can be wed if Catherine is wed first. So in 10 Things, I sort of tone this down. It's a rule for dating his daughters. And Smith and McCullough kind of contextualize this by making the father a gynecologist who's comically fearful of teenage pregnancy. So he thinks, okay, well, if I make it a rule that Bianca can't date, if Kat can't date, then neither of them will ever date. So The Taming of the Shrew is kind of a notoriously difficult text to translate because there's a lot of inherent misogyny contained in it. Mm-hmm. Kate and Petruchio, who is Heath Ledger's character, Patrick, in the film, tames her into being an obedient wife through starvation and kind of psychological abuse. Yeah.
Whoa.
By the end of it, he's telling her the sun is the moon and the moon is the sun, and she's agreeing with him. So there's a speech at the end of the play that Catherine makes, which is quite debated. Basically, she declares her loyalty to her husband and completely goes against everything she fought against at the beginning. If it's read sarcastically, we could see it as her still having a feminist stance, and it kind of shows how bang on trend Shakespeare was, even in the 1580s. But otherwise, it can be read as her complete subjugation at the hand of Petruchio. So that's why it's kind of difficult looking at it in modern context. How are they going to play this off? So in the movie, Patrick is paid into dating Kat, who's Julia Stiles, by a new student in school who wants to date Bianca. This is all getting very confusing. But basically, in the film, they kind of reimagine Kat as like a riot girl era feminist who wants to get into Sarah Lawrence College and is kind of over the whole high school thing. And they sort of tried to soften the character by getting rid of the maternal figure. So I think originally they'd written a mother into the script, but I think the studio saw it and they were like, we need to give her a reason to be angry, so we're going to get rid of the mother. Which kind of just goes to show that like women can't be angry for no reason in a film. But anyway, I think thinking back to my first watch of 10 Things, I always just thought like what a strong female character Kat was. And I think it's great that in the film she isn't really softened by the end. It's not that she's tamed. It's more that she does fall for Patrick. And I mean, Patrick himself is this kind of mythological character that like people have said that like he set a state trooper on fire and like he's supposed to be like this bad boy of the school, and he also looks a lot older. Like Heath Ledger was only 19. It was his first.
He looks 30.
Doesn't he? It was his first American role, because I think he was big over in Australia, but this is his first American role, and he just kind of like looks like a man compared to Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Cameron, who's trying to court Bianca, and like he looks about 12 years old.
I'm serious, man. He's whacked. He sold his own liver on the black market for a new set of speakers.
And so from the beginning, I think you kind of see like Patrick and Kat as a more romantic pairing than in the play, where it is just, I mean, they have this great kind of chemistry, but it ends so badly. So at the end of 10 Things, we have a speech which is actually lifted from McCullough's diaries. She made a list of 10 things she hated about her high school boyfriend. So I think they've kind of done a good twist on like the Shakespeare sonnets here as well. So the crux of the film is, I don't want to do any spoilers. Stop listening if you haven't watched the film. But so after finding out that Patrick has been paid to date her, she stands up in class and reads a poem about 10 things she hates about him, which kind of devolves into a declaration of love, which I think on my first watch, I remember cringing at, but watching back, it's just actually really sweet. Mm-hmm. And it's a really ingenious way to kind of get her emotions across and display how she's grappling with the hurt and anger over Patrick, but also still extremely hung up on him. And she apparently did it in one take as well, which is very impressive, and she cries in it and everything. So yeah, there's just slight nods to Shakespeare in the film. Like Patrick is named Patrick Verona, Verona being setting of Romeo and Juliet. Cass, their second name is Stratford, like Stratford upon Avon. And there's also, you know, the character of Michael, who's a friend of Cameron's in it, has this whole love quest of one of Kat's friends, and he does it through Shakespearean language, and they dress up in Shakespearean clothes. So it's kind of wearing its inspiration on its sleeve a bit more than Clueless. And I guess that, like, both heroines in it have to deal with tyrannical fathers and absent mothers, and there's still strong sisterly bonds in both films, like Kat and Bianca, the two sisters, where, and Cher and Dionne, their kind of sisterly relationship, which sometimes outshadow the romantic ones. And I guess both movies are a good example of how they kind of deepened the human experience portrayed on film, and it wasn't just vacuous characters like Cher. It's her spirit that shines through, and she's able to kind of recognize her error in ways and repent them. And in the same way that, like, Kat is still a feminist character in the end, she doesn't go back on any of her leanings just because she falls in love with Patrick. Mm-hmm. Kind of allows her to be both at once, which is rare for a teen movie, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That's it?
I think that's it.
Okay, so that's it. We have spoken about some of our favourite book to or text to film adaptations, and we will be back with you next month. So thank you for listening.